From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We're talking about a wartime foreign intelligence program. It is an early warning system with only one purpose: to detect and prevent the next attack on the United States from foreign agents hiding in our midst.
This administration has taken the view, in this case, in the torture case, in the cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment issue, that it can literally override the law and violate criminal statutes.
Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez goes to Georgetown University in the Bush administration's week-long PR campaign that could be dubbed Why We Spy. Critics call the program illegal. Students wearing black hoods stood up during his speech and turned their backs. Then we hear the story of an Iraqi journalist and doctor detained by U.S. forces.
Early this month, American forces raided my house. They used explosives to open the doors and they shot inside our rooms. Later on, they took me for detention for a few hours.
Ali Fadel joins us in our Firehouse studio, and in a Democracy Now! U.S. broadcast exclusive, we air excerpts of his documentary, Fallujah, The Real Story. All that and more coming up.
We found the bodies right behind their front doors. It looked to me as if they'd opened their front doors to the Americans and had been immediately shot dead. That's how we found them.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Capitol Hill, the Senate Judiciary Committee voted Tuesday to recommend the confirmation of Samuel Alito as a Supreme Court justice. As expected, the vote was split along party lines, with 10 Republicans in favor and 8 Democrats opposed. The Democratic opposition included 3 senators who voted for John Roberts in September. On Tuesday, another 5 Republicans announced they would support Alito in the overall Senate, giving him over 50 votes in the 100-member chamber. The final Senate debate on Alito's nomination begins today. The Supreme Court has issued a last-minute stay of execution in the case of a Florida death row prisoner who claims he's mentally retarded. Lawyers for Clarence Hill, who'd been scheduled to be executed at Florida State Prison Tuesday night, are also challenging the state on what kinds of drugs would be used for Hill's execution. He was convicted for the 1982 shooting of a police officer. In Venezuela, the second session of this year's World Social Forum opened in Caracas Tuesday. The forum, now in its 6th year, wrapped up in Mali this week and will continue in Pakistan in March. Over 67,000 participants are in Venezuela for the 6-day event. This is Nora Cartina, a member of the Argentinian group Mothers of the Plaza de Mayo.
We come to the World Social Forum to see if we can find that other America that is possible. Without hunger, with jobs, with respect to human rights, and without the terrorism of the United States. The wars and the invasions don't do anything more but kill and kill innocents.
Nora Cortina of the Mothers of the Disappeared. In other news, a UN commission has submitted the final report of its inquiry into the 24-year Indonesian occupation of Timor. The report concludes Indonesian forces caused the deaths of over 180,000 East Timorese, 90% of those deaths caused by forced starvation, and that Indonesian forces used napalm and chemical weapons to poison food and water. The report calls for East Timor to be paid substantial reparations, not just from Indonesia, but also from countries that supported its military occupation, including Australia and the United States. The Indonesian government has denied the report's main conclusions. Last week, the defense minister said, quote, "This is a war of numbers and data about things that never happened." In the occupied territories, Palestinians are voting today in their first parliamentary elections in a decade. Recent polls put Fatah, the ruling party that governs the Palestinian Authority, in a dead heat with Hamas. All of the major Palestinian factions are taking part in the elections, with the exception of Islamic Jihad. The U.S. has been accused of meddling in the elections amid revelations it clandestinely funneled $2 million into public service projects in an effort to increase the popularity of the Palestinian Authority. Meanwhile, acting Israeli minister Ehud Olmert is serving in place of the ailing Ariel Sharon. He outlined his diplomatic platform Tuesday. In a keynote address, Olmert pledged to continue with Sharon's plan to retain Israeli control over the main settlement blocks and security zones in the occupied West Bank. Jerusalem would also remain Israel's undivided capital. Olmert did not rule out the expansion of existing Israeli settlements, saying only settlement construction would be limited. In Haiti, residents of the poor neighborhood of Cité Soleil marched Tuesday in opposition to a low number of available polling stations in their community. Only six polling stations will be available for the neighborhood's 200,000 residents. Critics say the UN mission and the interim government is attempting to disenfranchise voters in neighborhoods known to support Lavalas, the movement of ousted Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Haiti's elections will be held on February 7th. The Swiss politician heading a European investigation into allegations the CIA operated secret prisons in Europe accused the Bush administration Tuesday of, quote, gangster-style methods. In an interim report, Dick Marty, a Swiss senator, wrote, quote, individuals have been abducted, deprived of their liberty and all rights, and transported to different destinations in Europe to be handed over to countries in which they have suffered degrading treatment and torture. Marty added, there is credible evidence that points to the operation of the secret CIA prisons, but did not provide any details. The leading internet search company, Google, has announced it'll launch a China-based version of its website that'll censor search results in accordance with demands of the Chinese government. Google says it will mitigate the censorship by informing users when search results are censored. But topics such as democratic reform, Taiwanese independence, or the banned Falun Gong movement will be off limits. The news comes amid revelations other major online firms have gone even further in meeting government censorship demands. Last year, Microsoft launched a Chinese portal that bars the use of words such as freedom and democracy in the names of weblogs. Meanwhile, Yahoo has admitted it aided authorities in the prosecution of a Chinese journalist by disclosing information about his email account. Back in the United States, a new Pentagon study says U.S. involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan has drastically overstretched the Army to the point it's become a, quote, thin green line. The report says the Army's, quote, in a race against time to avert a catastrophic decline. Andrew Krepinevich, a retired Army officer who wrote the report, told the Associated Press, quote, you really begin to wonder just how much stress and strain there is on the Army, how much longer it can continue. Meanwhile, the U.S. military has made what it calls a major revision to its rules covering military executions. The new rules would allow for executions at prisons aside from Fort Leavenworth in Kansas. That prison's currently the lone authorized site. Meanwhile, the military is denying a spokesperson's initial claims that the rule changes could apply to detainees held at Guantanamo Bay. In other news, the senators leading a congressional investigation into the government's response to Hurricane Katrina are accusing the Bush administration of thwarting their inquiry. Senators Susan Collins and Joe Lieberman, co-chairs of the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee, said Tuesday the White House is barring administration officials from answering questions and is failing to hand over documents. The senators also singled out officials at the Homeland Security, Justice, and Health and Human Services departments for ignoring their document requests. Collins, who's a Republican, called the White House's stance, quote, completely inappropriate. This news from El Salvador. Former guerrilla commander and ex-presidential candidate Shafik Handal has died of a heart attack. He was 75. Handal was a senior member of the Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front, known as the FMLN. Formed in 1980, the group waged an armed struggle against successive U.S.-backed right-wing governments, which were responsible for the deaths of tens of thousands of Salvadorans. In 2004, Handal lost a bid for El Salvador's presidency, and an election critics charge was unfairly influenced by the Bush administration. And Rose Bouzien Nader has died. A native of Lebanon, she was the matriarch of the family of consumer advocate and former presidential candidate Ralph Nader. Nader moved to the United States in the 1920s, where she became a celebrated teacher, civic advocate, and author. Rose Nader would have been 100 years old next month. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We now turn to Alberto Gonzalez, defending the NSA domestic spy programs. On Tuesday, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez appeared at Georgetown Law School to deliver an address defending the program. During the course of his speech, nearly 30 students stood up one by one and turned their backs on him in protest. The students stayed standing throughout the speech. Five students stood up, wore black hoods, reminiscent of the ones used at Abu Ghraib. They then held a banner reading the words of Benjamin Franklin, "Those who would sacrifice liberties in the name of security deserve neither." Third-year law student Devin Chafee said later, quote, "We believe that as law students, we must stand up for the rule of law over the creation of a culture of fear." The Gonzalez speech comes as part of a coordinated effort by the Bush administration to increase public support for the domestic surveillance program. Since Friday, President Bush, presidential advisor Karl Rove, former NSA head General Michael Hayden, and now Alberto Gonzalez have all given major speeches. Today, the president is scheduled to make a rare visit to the NSA headquarters in Fort Meade, Maryland. Following Gonzalez's address on Tuesday, Georgetown Law School hosted a panel to discuss the constitutionality of the spy program. In a few minutes, we'll hear why law professor David Cole says the NSA spying operation is clearly illegal. But first, we turn to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez.
Now, some contend that even if the president has constitutional authority to engage in the surveillance of our enemy in a time of war, and that's what we're talking about here, that that authority has been constrained by Congress with the passage in 1978 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. As you know, generally FISA requires the government to obtain an order from a special FISA court before conducting electronic surveillance. Now, we do not have to decide whether, when we are at war and there is a vital need for the terrorist surveillance program, FISA unconstitutionally encroaches or places an unconstitutional constraint upon the president's Article II powers. We can avoid that tough question because Congress gave the president the force resolution, and that statute removes any possible tension between what Congress said in 1978 FISA and the president's constitutional authority today. Now, you may have heard about the provision of FISA that allows the president to conduct warrantless surveillance for 15 days following a declaration of war. That provision shows that Congress knew that warrantless surveillance would be essential in wartime. But no one could reasonably suggest that all such critical military surveillance in a time of war would end after only 15 days. Instead, the legislative history of this provision makes it clear that Congress elected not to decide how surveillance might need to be conducted in the event of a particular armed conflict. Congress expected that it would revisit the issue in light of events and likely would enact a special authorization during that 15-day period. And that is exactly what happened 3 days after the attacks of 9/11. When Congress passed the force resolution permitting the president to exercise all necessary and appropriate incidents of military force. Thus, it is simply not the case that Congress in 1978 anticipated all the ways that the president might need to act in times of armed conflict to protect the United States. FISA, by its own terms, was not intended to be the last word on these critical issues. Second, some people have argued that by their terms, Title III and FISA are the exclusive means for conducting electronic surveillance. It is true that the law says that Title III and FISA are the exclusive means by which electronic surveillance may be conducted. But as I've said before, FISA itself says elsewhere that the government cannot engage in electronic surveillance except as authorized by statute. It is noteworthy that FISA did not say the government cannot engage in electronic surveillance except as authorized by FISA in Title III. No, it said except as authorized by statute, any statute. And in this case, that other statute is the force resolution. Even if some might think that that's not the only way to read the statute, in accordance with long recognized canons of construction, FISA must be interpreted in harmony with the force resolution to allow the president as commander-in-chief during time of armed conflict to take the actions necessary to protect the country from another catastrophic attack. And so long as such interpretation is fairly possible, the Supreme Court has made it clear that it must be adopted in order to avoid the serious constitutional issues that would otherwise be raised. Third, I keep hearing, why not FISA? Why didn't the president get orders from the FISA court approving these NSA intercepts of Al-Qaeda communications? We have to remember that we're talking about a wartime foreign intelligence program. It is an early warning system with only one purpose: to detect and prevent the next attack on the United States from foreign agents hiding in our midst. It is imperative for national security reasons that we can detect reliably, immediately, and without delay whenever communications associated with Al-Qaeda enter or leave the United States. Now, some have pointed to the provision in FISA that allows for so-called emergency authorizations of surveillance for 72 hours without a court order. I think that there is a serious misconception about these emergency authorizations. People should know that we do not approve emergency authorizations without knowing that we will receive court approval within 72 hours. FISA requires me, the Attorney General, to determine in advance that a FISA application for that particular intercept will be fully supported and will be approved by the court before an emergency authorization may be granted. And that review process itself can take precious time. To initiate surveillance under a FISA emergency authorization, it is not enough to rely on the best judgment of our intelligence officers alone. Those intelligence officers would have to get the sign-off of lawyers at the NSA that all provisions of FISA have been satisfied. Then lawyers in the Department of Justice would have to be similarly satisfied. And finally, as Attorney General, I would have to be satisfied that the search meets the requirements of FISA. And then we would have to be prepared to follow up with a full FISA application within the 72 hours. We all agree that there should be appropriate checks and balances on our branches of government. The FISA process makes perfect sense in almost all cases of foreign intelligence monitoring in the United States. Although technology has changed dramatically since FISA was enacted, FISA remains a vital tool in the war on terror, and one that we are using to its fullest and will continue to use against Al-Qaeda and other foreign threats. But as the President has explained, the terrorist surveillance program operated by the NSA requires a maximum in speed and agility, and since even a very short delay may make the difference between success and failure in preventing the next attack. And we cannot afford to fail.
Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez speaking at Georgetown University Law Center yesterday. Gonzalez left immediately after his talk without taking questions. Protesters followed. Also, panelists responded to what the Attorney General had to say. One of the panelists was David Cole, law professor at Georgetown and author of several books, including Terrorism and the Constitution, Sacrificing Civil Liberties in the Name of National Security.
FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, was enacted by Congress in 1978 after revelations of rampant wiretapping and surveillance on Americans in the name of national security. And there was the Church Committee held extensive hearings and wrote an extensive report criticizing this practice and calling for reforms. FISA was one such reform. It regulates electronic surveillance for foreign intelligence and national security purposes. It permits such surveillance, but with minor exceptions not invoked by the Department of Justice. It requires a warrant from a FISA court. To get such a warrant, you don't have to show probable cause of a crime. You just have to show probable cause that the person you're targeting is a member of a terrorist organization. So if, in fact, that's all they were targeting, they could have gone through the FISA courts. They didn't. Congress in FISA specifically said that FISA and the Title III, which governs ordinary criminal wiretaps, are the exclusive means for any wiretapping by officials within the United States. They are the exclusive means. That means the only means. Congress also said it's a crime to conduct electronic surveillance without statutory authorization in two places, in 50 U.S.C. Section 1809 and in 18 U.S.C. Section 2511. Both of those statutes, I think, the President violated. And finally, and most importantly, Congress specifically contemplated the exact question addressed today, that is, authorization for wiretapping during wartime. Section 1811 of FISA is entitled Authorization During Time of War. So this is not some uncontemplated issue. Congress specifically addressed it. And what they said was, when we've declared war, the President can conduct warrantless wiretapping, but only for 15 days. And they said in the legislative history, this is so if the President needs further authority, he can come to us and ask for that authority. The President didn't do that here. He simply went ahead and did it without asking for their authority. Now, the DOJ's argument, and repeated here by the Attorney General, is that the AUMF, the authorization to use military force, somehow implicitly overrides all of this and authorizes the President to conduct warrantless wiretapping. There are several problems with that argument. First, the authorization says nothing about warrantless wiretapping. Second, as I've indicated, Section 1811 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act specifically addresses this question of warrantless wiretapping and says 15 days and no further. And that provision applies when Congress has declared war, the most serious and grave act Congress can do. Here, Congress only authorized the use of military force. So if Congress said a declaration of war only gives you 15 days, how can it be that an authorization to use military force somehow gives him 4 years and more of unchecked power? In addition, when Attorney General Gonzalez was asked by reporters why he didn't go to Congress and ask for additional authority, he said, well, we talked to some members of Congress, and they said it would be difficult, if not impossible, to get that additional authority. So how can you argue, on the one hand, Congress gave us the authority, but on the other hand, we didn't go to Congress to ask for the authority, because if we did, it would be difficult, if not impossible, to get it. Now, when you're a law student, they tell you, if you can't argue the law, argue the facts. They also say, if you can't argue the facts, argue the law. If you can't argue either, apparently, the solution is to go on a public relations offensive and make it a political issue, because that's what the Bush administration has done here, sort of taking the pulpit through the President, through the Attorney General, through Michael Hayden, through the Vice President, to say over and over and over again it's lawful, as if the American people will somehow come to believe this if we say it often enough. And I think in light of that, the sort of clearly, blatantly political nature of this, I'm proud of the very civil disobedience that was shown here today to express the opposite political view. Now, David Brooks, in commenting on the Alito hearings, which discussed these issues, said, anytime the Democrats are seen talking about law and the Republicans are seen to be talking about national security, that's a winner for the Republicans. And that may be true as a political matter. In fact, Karl Rove said exactly the same thing just last week, that there's a political gain here that they see by invoking fear and national security over law. But that's precisely why we have law in the first place. It's in recognition that political pressures will push government officials toward violation of rights and towards accretion of government power. This administration has taken the view in this case, in the torture case, in the cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment issue, that it can literally override the law and violate criminal statutes. Now it's on a political campaign to entrench that power. What's at stake here is whether we are a government of laws rather than a government of men.
David Cole, law professor at Georgetown, one of the panelists responding to the speech made by Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez at Georgetown University Law Center yesterday. President Bush heads to the National Security Agency today in the week-long Bush administration campaign that could be called Why We Spy. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we return, an Iraqi journalist whose home was raided by U.S. journalists and was detained. He's come to this country. This is his first interview. Stay with us.
First thing when I wake up, and right before I close my eyes at night, I think, sense, feel, man, like I'm under some kind of microscope. Satellites over my head, transmitters in my dollars, hawking, watching, scoping, shocking, scrutinizing me, checking to see what I'm doing, where I be, who I see, how and where and with whom I make my money. What is this? Excuse me, miss, may I have your phone number and your social security? Who, me? When all I came to do was buy my double or triple A batteries, please, I decline.
Jill Scott watching me here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 400 stations around the country, on Pacifica, NPR, and low power FM college and community stations, as well as on public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. There is still no word on kidnapped American journalist Jill Carroll. On Monday, her father, Jim, appeared on CNN and urged her kidnappers to release her alive. She was seized in Baghdad on January 7th. Meanwhile, the Committee to Protect Journalists Monday called for the U.S. military to free two journalists, one held without charge in Iraq, the other detained at Guantanamo Bay. CPJ also demanded an explanation from the U.S. military for holding a Reuters TV cameraman for 8 months without charge until his release Sunday. Today, we look at the story of another Iraqi journalist who was also detained by U.S. forces in Iraq, Ali Fadil. On January 8th, American troops in Baghdad blasted their way into Ali Fadil's home, an Iraqi journalist working for the London Daily, The Guardian, and TV's Channel 4 in Britain. Soldiers reportedly enter his home, fired bullets into the bedroom where he and his wife and children were sleeping. Fadil was hooded and questioned for several hours. He says U.S. troops gave him $1,500 for damage to his home, then dropped him off alone in a dangerous Baghdad neighborhood. In November, Fadil won the Foreign Press Association Award for Young Journalist of the Year. He's currently at work on a documentary about the U.S. and British government's misuse of Iraqi funds. He says U.S. troops have not returned several videotapes they took from him. The director of the documentary, Callum McRae, said the timing and nature of this raid is extremely disturbing. It's only a few days since we first approached the U.S. authorities and told them Ali was doing this investigation and asked them then to grant him an interview about our findings. Ali Fadil joins us in our Firehouse studio for the first time since he's come to the United States yesterday. In addition to being an award-winning journalist, Ali is a general physician. He arrived in the U.S. from Baghdad this week. Welcome to Democracy Now! Welcome. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you.
So first, describe for us what happened to you on January 8th. This was actually the day after Jill Carroll, the U.S. journalist, was kidnapped.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's a response for Gerald Carl abduction. So the U.S. forces came at 12:30 after midnight, and they raided the house. They used explosives on the three doors of the house.
What time was it?
At 12:30.
Were you sleeping? Midnight.
Yeah, we were sleeping, all of us, because there is no electricity in Iraq, so we sleep early. We were sleeping, me and my wife and my kids, on one bed in our room, and the rest of the house, they're sleeping downstairs. We just heard the explosion, and then all the windows broken down. We thought there is a kind of mortar or a rocket fallen on our house. After that, my wife called me to go downstairs, but I just said, let's just wait. And just seconds, we saw a rifle coming out through the door and shooting a couple of bullets inside the room. We didn't know where he's just shooting. I covered my wife and my child, my daughter Sarah and Adam.
How old are they?
Well, Sarah, she's 3 years, and Adam, 7 months. And they were, you know, they were crying and shouting, and my wife also crying. And just seconds, we saw American soldiers surrounding the bed. One of them took me from the bed, and he rolled me out of the bed on the ground, and he tied my hands after searching me. My daughter Sarah, she was crying, and she was afraid from Americans previously, actually. Whenever she sees them in the streets, she's afraid from them. Even she calls Iraqi soldiers Americans. She can't differentiate. So she was calling for me, "Daddy, Daddy, Americans, they're going to take you," as she always said. After that, I tried to ask them for the reason why they came here, what they're looking for.
And you could speak to them. You speak English.
Yeah, exactly. I tried to explain that I'm a reporter. They didn't care, and they just told me to shut up. Minutes later, they took me downstairs, and they walked me down with tied hands. I was looking to the house. There was about 20 soldiers in the house. They were smashing furniture, looking everywhere. I don't know for what at that time. And after that, they took me to the living room where they were also searching. They told me to sit on a chair, and one of them came and he hooded my face. And he brought a dog who was barking on me. It was barking on me, and he threatened me if I talk one word, the dog gonna bite me.
He put a hood over your head?
Yeah, a hood over my head. And after that, and the dog was barking on me. After that, one of the soldiers, or maybe a captain, I don't know exactly, he came to me with a handycam camera I usually use in my work. And there's a tape rolling inside, and he said, "Watch this and explain to me why you have this." And I watched it. It was a tape for me from Palestine Hotel balcony shooting and into the green zone, and I was talking to the camera. And they said, "Yes, I shot this tape. I took it 2 days ago from Palestine Hotel." And he said, "Do you know that these places were targeted recently?" I said, "No, it wasn't, because yesterday I was inside the green zone in the anniversary for the Iraqi army, and I was shooting, filming inside the green zone, and nothing is there." Then he left me, and returned back me after minutes, and he said, "Are you a reporter?" I said, "Yes, I am." And I explained whom I'm working for, and the Guardian Films, British TV, Channel 4. And he said, "This house belongs to someone. His name is Ali Mahmoud al-Mashhadani." I said, "No, no way. This house belongs to my father-in-law. His name is Abdul Karim Abbas Hamoudi. And he's been living here for 8 years. He built this house. And Mashhadani is a Sunni house, while this house is a Shiite house. If you go to the other one, you will see a big picture for Imam Ali, which is an indicator that this is a Shiite house." Later on, he left me for like half an hour maybe, and he turned back to me with a paper, a document in his hand, and he showed me a picture of a lady. I didn't know who's she at the time, wearing a big eyeglasses. I recognized that she could be the reporter kidnapped in near my neighborhood. And I said, "I don't know. Maybe she's the reporter." He said, "Yes, she is. How do you know her?" I said, "I don't know. I just heard in the news." And then he said, "Do you know where is she?" I said, "No." He said, "She's in this house." I said, "No, she's not." And he showed me another picture for a man with a beard. And he said, "Do you know this guy?" I said, "Yes, I know this guy." He said, "How do you know him?" I said, "Well, because his picture's inside the green zone and the convention center where we go always, we reporters, journalists. And I know that he's wanted for the U.S. forces." He said, "He's living in this house." I said, "No, he's not." Then he left me for a while. He came with another captain or officer, and they were talking to me nicely this time. And they said, "We need to investigate. We need with you. We need information, but we can't do it properly here. We need to take it somewhere. We need to take you somewhere else and do the investigation, and then we will release you after 1 hour." I said, "It's fine if you're taking just me alone and not taking anyone in the house." And I said, "Yes, we just will take you. But we have to keep your hands tied, and we'll hood your face. This is for you and for us, for the safety." And they put me in an armed vehicle, and the armed vehicle drove like for maybe half an hour or more than that, less, I couldn't tell. and for a long distance, actually. And finally, I found myself in a small room with wooden walls and an oval table in the middle and the refrigerator and the bed on the ground. And there was an American soldier with a pistol, and he was guarding me. Seconds later on, two civilians, Americans, came into the room, and they were wearing vests. And they said, "Mr. Fadil, do you know why you are here?" I said, "Yes, to investigate me." He said, "No, there was a mistake, and we apologize for what happened. We're going to release you as soon as the curfew ends in the morning." I said, "So you didn't come for the reporter?" He said, "We can't say anything. That's all what we can say, and that's it." I said, "Then what about the damages for the house and the compensations?" He said, "Of course, in the morning, people will come and negotiate with you the compensations." And they offered for me the bed, and I tried to sleep. But, you know, because of the shock, it was very difficult for me to sleep. I was thinking about what's happening back at home. The doors were broken, and it's very cold, and the house is damaged. And my daughter, I didn't know what she's doing at that time. After that, I woke up in the morning. Two men, also two different civilian men, Americans. They were wearing vests and clothes. Looks like the local, the private security people in Baghdad. And they said, "Mr. Fadil, excuse us, we want to talk with you, and now we're going to release you." And I said, "Okay." And they took an envelope out of, one of them took an envelope out of his pocket. There was a money, cash money, 100 bills. And he said, "This is the money for the compensations. We'll offer you, this is $1,000 for the damages of the house, and this is $500 for the time you spent with us here in the detention." And I said, "It's fine. I didn't negotiate anything. I didn't say anything. I just want to go out and see my family, because it's for me, I thought it's going to be longer than this. But I was feeling all right. I mean, it was a mistake, obviously." I took the money. I signed three documents, each one for the 500 bills, for the $500. And then they folded my eyes and my hands. They tied my hands, and they released my hands at that time. They took me to in a civilian car, four wheels drive car, and they drove right and left. I couldn't figure where I am at the beginning, and then they released me in a place. And when I removed the hood from my eyes, I saw barricades. Long barricades, about 3 meters height barricades from each side, and I didn't know where exactly. They gave me money for the taxi, and I walked out of the barricades. I found myself in the south gate of the Green Zone, in an area which is very, very dangerous, very well known for car bombs and assassinations, because it's the gate where Iraqis working for Americans in the Green Zone come in and out from. And I took a cab, went back home. I found the house worse than I expected. The car that we have, a BMW, it was damaged, and all the windows broken, the furniture smashed. My wife, she was crying when she saw me. She hugged me, and she didn't believe I'm released. And I found one of my my brother-in-law. He was beaten a lot by the American forces because he doesn't speak English. He couldn't understand what they want from him. And also my father-in-law, he was beaten, and he had some wounds on his chest because of the glass. They grabbed him and they on the ground, and there was some glass. So that's all what I found.
Ali Fadil. An Iraqi journalist who has done a documentary that we're going to air for the first time in this country. But that tape that they showed you in your camera, do you have it now?
No, actually. No, I lost that tape. Couldn't find it when I came back home. I couldn't find that tape. It's just one tape which shows me standing on the balcony and some shots of the Green Zone, which we thought of using it in the film we are working on right now for Channel 4.
Did you ask for it back?
Yes, of course, we asked for it, and Channel 4, Channel Director asked for it from the U.S. Embassy. And recently, before a few days, we received a letter from Zalmay Khalilzada, the U.S. Ambassador in Baghdad, for apology for what happened. And he denied that there is any tape taken from my house.
Now, what about Channel 4 talking to the U.S. forces before you were taken away, before they raided your house, to tell them that you were doing this film and wanted to interview them?
Yeah, you see, the film we're working on, it's on the reconstruction. It's kind of dangerous to say that I'm working on this film while I'm moving in different cities, because it's hazardous for me, as for my security. It's hazardous for the film that we're working on, because we can't find anything. So what happened is, recently, the Channel 4 people, they contacted the U.S. Side for permissions for interviews with people responsible for the reconstruction in Iraq. And that's why Channel 4 people, they have their own concerns about the timing of the raid. But myself, I would say it's a mistaken identity. This is what I believe.
Ali Fadil is our guest, has just come to this country. He is making one film now, was arrested in the midst of making that film. When we come back from break, we're going to play an excerpt of the film he finished for Channel 4 called Fallujah, The Real Story. Stay with us. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Ali Fadil is perhaps best known for his documentary film on the aftermath of the U.S. siege in Fallujah, November 2004. In the assault, U.S. and Iraqi forces surrounded Fallujah, expelling the city's residents, bombing hospitals, shelling buildings. Whole neighborhoods were attacked. Relief workers were denied access. When the dust had settled, 10,000 buildings were destroyed, with thousands more seriously damaged. At least 100,000 residents were permanently displaced, and over 70 U.S. soldiers were killed. The Iraqi death toll remains unknown, but is well into the hundreds. Ali Fadil compiled the first independent reports from the devastated city, where he found scores of unburied corpses, rabid dogs, and an embittered population. In a Democracy Now! U.S. exclusive, today we air an excerpt of this documentary. It was produced by Guardian Films for Channel 4 News in Britain. This is Fallujah, The Real Story.
Fallujah has been closed as a city for 2 months. Nahida is one of the first Fallujahs to go back home since the Americans occupied the city. She wanted to show me what had been left behind.
Look at it. Furniture, clothes thrown everywhere. They smashed up the cupboards and they wrote something bad in the dressing table mirror.
She doesn't speak English, so I explained to her what the words mean.
I knew it. I knew those words were insulting.
Every Fallujah knows the song. It was written after the war and is full of hatred towards the Americans. It's impossible to live in the city at the moment. There is no water, no electricity, and no sewage. It's almost a city of ghosts. Most of the 350,000 people who used to live there now live in refugee camps. I wanted to get inside the city, but it was closed. So I started by looking for Fallujans in the surrounding villages and camps. I began my journey in Habaniya, 35 kilometers west of Fallujah. This place used to be a tourist resort. Saddam's own son, Uday, used to come here for his holidays. People here are cutting down trees and making fires to keep warm. Abu Rabia has been living here for 2 months now.
We're meant to be the country of oil, aren't we? But look at me, I'm measuring the kerosene for this lamp by the drop. We've no heat here, we're using wood for the fire.
These people are freezing. They have received no food aid for 3 months. They are meant to be voting on January the 30th.
We won't vote. We just won't vote. They must take us back to our houses first.
Inside one of the tents, I met Hamid Allawi. I asked him if he had received his voting papers.
No, I didn't receive them, and I don't want them anyway. None of the Fallujans here have got their voting coupons.
Suddenly we were told that some people were unhappy that we were filming. It felt dangerous, and we had to leave. We go straight to Saklawiya, a village just north of Fallujah. At Friday prayers, the talk is all about the elections.
When they hand out food rations, they should give out voting papers as well. Why isn't the government giving the people their vote?
Sheikh Jamal al-Muhammadi is a powerful man. Many Fallujah refugees come to listen to his sermons. He gets very emotional when he talks about last November's attack.
And I saw with my own eyes the Holy Quran thrown on the floor of the mosque by those sons of pigs and monkeys. The Americans were treading on the Holy Quran and it broke my heart.
I wanted to speak to the Sheikh because back in November the Americans had asked him to remove bodies from Fallujah. I wanted to know what he'd seen.
The Americans had marked the houses that had dead bodies in them with a cross. That's where we found the martyrs. In my opinion, these people were civilians, not terrorists. They were men who had stayed behind in the city to protect their homes. I say this because we found the bodies in groups of two or three or four. It was Ramadan and people would naturally gather together for iftar, the first meal after fasting. We found the bodies right behind their front doors. It looked to me as if they'd opened their front doors to the Americans and had been immediately shot dead. That's how we found them.
Sheikh Jamal took me to a cemetery on the edge of the city. He showed me where he had buried the bodies. He claimed none of them had weapons with them and that he had found an old man of 90 who had been shot dead in his kitchen. The gravestones had no names, only numbers. I counted 76 of them. The Americans claim they killed 1,200. So even if these people were insurgents, where are the other graves? I wanted to get inside Fallujah itself, but to do that, I have to get the new Fallujah identity card. Everyone who wants to return to the city now has to get this ID from the American military. To most Iraqis, this seems crazy. It's the only place in Iraq where you need an ID in order to get into your own city.
This card will allow them to get back into the city in a controlled, organized manner.
But the men queuing for the card told me they saw it as another punishment given to them by the Americans. Fallujans have always been so proud of their city. Concepts such as honor and dignity matter a lot here. So to be fingerprinted by an American soldier just to go home is embarrassing. That's why these men are covering their faces.
This is just another humiliation for the people of Fallujah. I think they are doing it on purpose, just to humiliate us.
My understanding is ultimately they can hang that card on the wall and keep it as a souvenir, but eventually, not too distant in the future, that card's going to be unnecessary for access to Fallujah.
Finally, we made it into Fallujah. The first thing we noticed was graffiti saying long live the Mujahideen. I couldn't believe it. The whole city is destroyed. It was a big shock. I wasn't prepared for this much destruction. I was here just before the American attack. It's hard to believe. This is the same city. Fallujah used to be one of the few modern Iraqi cities, and now there is nothing. The only people I see are Fallujahs trying to work out where they used to live. People like Abu Salah, this is all that remains of his home.
Look at these mattresses here. These were for my son's wedding. This was my son's room. And look here, this was our kitchen. This is the sugar bag that we left in the kitchen right here. If Alawi really wants us to vote in the elections, then let him come here first and look at the state we're living in.
I could smell bodies beneath the rubble. I went to the old city of Fallujah. This was the place where the four American contractors were brutally lynched last March. The Americans don't allow anyone to go here. They say it's not safe. It is a scary place, but these Fallujah people insist on taking me somewhere. They want to show me something really gruesome. I counted four dead bodies. They were rotting. It looks like these people were shot while they were sleeping. It's very common for friends in Iraq to sleep in this way together. There are no signs of a gun battle, no bullet holes. I could not see any weapons, no obvious signs that they were insurgents. I'm told they were civilians. Nearby, in another house, another dead body. But here, there were definite signs that this was an insurgent. There is an RPG launcher on the roof of his car and a booby trap bomb by the door. In both cases, the corpses have been eaten by hungry dogs. I see a lot of dead dogs in the city. There is a serious outbreak of rabies.
We received in our hospital many, many cases suspected to be rabies. You know, we have no toxin or vaccine in our hospital. So most of patients died.
Do you have a figure about the numbers, 20, 30?
About 50 cases.
Dr. Chichen and his colleagues are living in Fallujah's main hospital. The city is empty, so they have no patients. Their only job is to recover the rotting corpses and to bring them for burial. When I went to the main cemetery in Fallujah, they were still burying their dead. 2 months after the fighting started, we still don't know how many Fallujahs died. But we do know the American casualty figures. 51 U.S. soldiers were killed and over 400 were wounded.
Ali Fadil's documentary, Fallujah, The Real Story, produced by Guardian Films for Channel 4 in Britain. This U.S. exclusive, an excerpt of that film. Ali, your conclusion at the end of the film, which we are not playing right now.
Yeah, it's about the defeat of the insurgency that the U.S. forces claimed at that time, because they said this is a big win for us against the insurgents in Iraq, which actually wasn't true. With the time they raid on the Fallujah, there was exclusive and enormous military operations in different areas in Iraq, especially, for example, Baghdad and Mosul. There were, for example, the raid, the explosion, the suicidal explosion inside one of the military camps, big military camp, American military camps in Nineveh, north of Iraq, and everywhere, actually. So the conclusion was that this is not true. The Americans, the insurgents, they just spread it out from Fallujah. They just fled Fallujah a few days before the American invasion of Fallujah.
You won the Foreign Press Association Award for this, Amnesty International's award, as well as others. And you've come here with a Fallujah ID. Now, it was talked about in the film, by an American major, Paul Hackett, who is now running for Senate in Ohio. He's who you interviewed there.
Yeah, well, I didn't know, actually. But I met him there in Fallujah in a camp where they do these ideas. American soldiers sitting beside computers and having computer machines and printers. So they print kind of ideas where they take the print of the iris, they take the print of your the 10 fingers, and then they give you this ID, which is you can't get in or out of Fallujah without it. It's with the picture, and you can see until now, this very day, Fallujahans can get in or out of their city without this ID.
And it's a photograph of you with a barcode at the top with your name written in English.
Exactly. So, yeah. So it can be read by the computer. And of course, I'm not a Fallujahan, and I had it by coincidence. I don't know how. It was very exclusive. You can see here the type of the Fallujah, of the personnel holding this ID is C, which is contractor. So I was allowed to get in as a contractor inside the Fallujah with the cameras and everything. Before I come to America, for a few days, I met two Fallujahans, friends of mine I made through this film, in Amman, in my way to America. And I asked them about the situation there, and they just said, it's just the same when you left it. It's seized. Nobody allowed to get in or out without this ID. And they're having problems with the Americans, Iraqi forces, and with the insurgents. So nothing changed, actually.
And how did you get these images? For example, the bodies at the end in their homes, dead. How did you get in?
Well, the thing is, that was the north part of the city, which is known in Fallujah as the souk. It was banned, and there were tapes, yellow tapes, saying danger, don't cross. And these were areas announced by the military forces. If you cross it, then it's green light for anybody to shoot you. So some Fallujahans actually said, you have to come to this place. You have to. Come with us. We'll get you. Don't worry. We'll take care of your safety. Some of the few Fallujahans who got in at these days, because these were the first days where Fallujahans civilians allowed to get in to see their houses. So they took me and they sneaked me through the smaller lanes and roads, and I found myself in these places, in this house. And actually, I got a shot from a sniper on me on the top of one of the buildings when I got the shot for the mosque, the Dome of the Mosque.
You're an unembedded journalist in
Iraq. Unembedded, yeah.
Compare that situation to the other reporting you're seeing from there.
Well, if you remember at that time, all the reports came to about Fallujah was from the journals embedded with the military forces, because they didn't allow anybody to get in, any media to get in. And everyone who wants to get in, he has to be embedded with the U.S. forces. So I would say this film is really, really something. It means a lot of things to me, and it's a kind of exclusive in the way it's been done, in the way the access we got inside the city, because it was dangerous not only from the military forces, from the American forces, but also from the insurgents inside.
We only have 30 seconds, but you're a general practitioner. You were a doctor in Iraq. Why did you put that down to pick up a camera?
The main reason is because while I'm sitting in 2003, I returned back to Iraq. I was in exile in Yemen, practicing also medicine. When I returned back, I found myself just writing death certificates and doing nothing to my patients. So I decided to, I mean, I was in a total despair, so I was ready to do anything. When I was visited by a Guardian reporter, he asked me to work as a translator with him. And when I started, I found the media is much, much stronger than medicine.
Well, Ali Fadil, I want to thank you for being with us now, coming to the United States to go to journalism school at New York University with your family. Welcome to the United States.
Thank you.
That does it for today's broadcast. You can go to our website for transcript, for video and audio at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Aaron Mate. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.